Eating Prevention Therapy.
Recording started.
Where I'm also a professor of applied psychology, global public health, and medicine. And Farzana and I, Farzana will introduce herself in a second, but Farzana and I are really happy to be here with you this morning to give you a sense of the work we've been doing over the last several years to try to really disentangle, you know, both the strengths and the challenges for a new generation of gay, bisexual, and other young men with sex with men. And I'm going to just from the start just say that we're going to just go ahead and probably use gay men just or YMSM moving forward. You know, there's a whole conversation that we can have about using a behavioral term versus an identity term. So we're going to go back and forth between those two terms probably throughout the course of this morning. But I want to say one of the most important things that we bring to the table this morning is this understanding and this belief that what we need to do to address this epidemic in this new generation cannot be based solely on what we've done in the past. And so we've really been trying as much as possible to understand this generation of young men and to bring to the table ideas and programs that will serve them in the most effective way.
So with that, thank you very much for joining us this morning. My name is Farzana Kapadia. I am an associate professor here at New York University in public health. I'm an epidemiologist by training, and I co-direct the Center for Health Identity, Behavior, and Prevention Studies here at NYU with Perry. And I'm really excited to be here and talk to all of you and to hear from you, get your feedback from you about this presentation and our work as well.
Right. So we have data, but we're going to try as much as possible to keep this as a talking about a story, and then sort of conclude with our main ideas here. And so Farzana and I, we've like spent some time breaking up the talk, so we're not talking at the same time. I will do a few slides, and she'll jump in, and we'll go back and forth. But I think, given sort of the depth of my voice, you can tell who's talking while we're going through the slideshow.
More or less.
Okay.
So I'm going to begin, and the first two slides are just sort of the background for the work that we do here. Likely none of this is new to you and probably very familiar to all of you, but it helps to sort of set the stage for the background and the context for this study called P18, which we'll be describing moving forward. And the first slide here basically shows you HIV diagnosis in New York City from 2008 to 2012. And as you can see, I guess we're starting up again. But basically that first slide showed that HIV diagnoses in New York City, at least, across HIV risk group have been changing over time. And while risks for IDUs and heterosexual transmission have sort of remained stable, among MSM between 2008 and 2012, HIV diagnoses were increasing. And then if you look within MSM, within that population, and you look within age groups, what you see is that while the diagnoses for men 30 and older were beginning to decline, we begin to see an increase in HIV diagnoses among men who are ages 13 and 29. So in this new generation of YMSM, what we begin to see is a different epidemiology for HIV than what we've seen previously, and it begins to give us questions about whether the prevention programs that have been implemented for an older generation are based on the research and extant information that was available for an older generation is really applicable to this younger generation. The next slide basically shows the HIV diagnoses by race, ethnicity. And again, this echoes the work that's been, and the statistics and the surveillance statistics especially that have been reported by the DOH, DOHMH, and that is that there's stark racial and ethnic disparities in HIV diagnoses among Black, non-Hispanic, Hispanic, white, non-Hispanic, and Asian Pacific Islanders, with Black, non-Hispanic young men, young MSM really bearing the greatest burden of HIV disease in New York City. So with that, what we want to talk to you a little bit about is the mission of CHIPS and how the work at CHIPS is really informed by the work that we're doing moving forward in the research studies. So I don't know where you guys are in the slides right now or what you see. What we see right now is our very first slide that shows the percentage of new diagnoses, which is slide 2. And we're going to try to advance to slide five.
We're having some trouble.
But Steve, we're not able to do that. We're having a little trouble, so I don't know if you're still working on that or not.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure what's going on. We have somebody with the name Shanda Kears who has somehow hijacked the presentation.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'm trying to
take it back
to see if to get that back.
Shanda, if you're on the phone and you can hear us, maybe if you can unclick whatever made you the host or presenter, that'd be great. Oh, well, now we're presenting.
And we're live. And
we're live. We're live.
Okay. Great.
So, there we go.
So we are now, I'm going to talk a little bit about our center, which has been a center that's existed here at NYU for some close to 20 years. And what I want to say is that the center that we run is a center that's informed by multiple paradigms. So we come to this work as, you know, psychologists and epidemiologists, as public health experts, as social workers, as nurses, you know, as physicians, coming together to truly understand primarily HIV, but not exclusively HIV. And in addition to that, in addition to the work that we do as a research center, we are a training ground for the next generation of scholars who are working in this field. So at any particular moment, on any particular day, there's some 25 to 50 students who are navigating our space, who are really the heart and soul of the work that we're doing. Because Farzan and I are really dedicated to this notion that our job is to put out good science, but our job is also to train the next generation. And so I want to just acknowledge them. Right now, there is a whole bunch of work going on at the center. We're going to talk a lot about the first study, Syndemic Production Among Emerging Adult Men. Talk a little bit about work we've done on sexual networks and on geospatial methods related to that study. We just completed a really interesting study with the Mount Sinai Health Systems on neurocognitive and psychiatric health for HIV-positive older adults, and are thinking about launching an intervention program with some of our colleagues in Toronto by the end of this year. And we've also undertaken a study of PrEP acceptability, both in terms of pill form and in terms of injectables. We are two more studies that are not on this chart. One, a study that one of our students is doing, looking at the dynamics and negotiation of sexual practices in non-monogamous couples. And then an additional study that I'll be launching with Farzana in the fall that is trying to disentangle why it is that young gay men, regardless of where they're coming from, regardless of race, SES, are falling through the cracks in healthcare as they transition from adolescence to young adulthood. And I think that we all know that men are more likely to not access healthcare as women. And I think there was a study that came out this weekend that said more men could tell you the make of their car than how to go to a doctor. and this is not you know, something that's confined to just heterosexual men.
Yeah.
It is also for gay men. And it may actually have much more importance for young gay men who are living in a population that's been bombarded with HIV for the last 30 years. So that's going to be a really interesting study for us, working with Dan O'Connell and his colleagues at the New York State AIDS Institute.
You know, particular salience for this notion or this, you know, new mission that we're on in terms of getting to zero.
Yep.
So basically the study that we're going to talk about and the study from which a lot of the data that will follow and the sub-studies that we've mentioned is the P18 study. It was a prospective cohort study that was launched about 5 years ago, and I say five because we'll move into this, but we're in the second phase of the study now. But about 5 years ago, we launched this prospective cohort study where we went out into the community and recruited young men between the ages of 18 and 19. The ages that were 18 and 19 were chosen because that's the age at which men are beginning to emerge into adulthood and really begin to identify and negotiate their sexual identity. And so we felt that that was an important starting point for this study. And then I'm going to turn it over to Perry so he can give you a little bit about the background
right.
of the framework for this.
So the framework for the work, as is going to be shown in the next slide, comes from a theory of syndemic production. Essentially what this shows and what we truly, truly believe is that HIV, shown in the lower half of the slide, is one of many overlapping health problems that young gay men experience. We do not believe that HIV exists in isolation. We believe that HIV is linked very closely to substance use, mental health issue, other STIs, violence and sexual abuse. You can expand it even more and add a variety of other health problems, and that these problems fuel each other. And so this is going to be one of our theses today, which is like you can't just think about HIV in isolation. And the other part of the chart shows our other belief, which is that this epidemic is not just a biological phenomenon, but it is a biological, behavioral, and psychosocial phenomenon. And that there are drivers, which are obvious drivers, like the transmission of the virus and levels of concentration in communities that affect transmission. There are behavioral influences, which we know we've all been addressing for the last 30 years, which, while important, are insufficient in and of themselves, but also that there are structural problems and social issues. And when we think about inequalities and we think about discrimination, that these matters are just as important in combating the HIV epidemic and other health problems sexual minorities face in our country. And so targeting HIV by attacking the epidemic on all of these fronts, the medical, the biological, the biological, the behavioral, and the psychosocial and structural, are equally important from our perspective. And, you know, one thing I wrote about many years ago was, you know, we use three different drugs to fight HIV. We need a combination of approaches that transgress all of these influences to really attack HIV.
The only thing I would add to that as well is that, you know, we tend to look at disease and we tend to study or do work within this population based on a deficit model. And what we want to do also is think about the psychosocial and structural influences so that we can try to think of what factors can increase the resilience against these outcomes, unwanted negative outcomes. So that's another reason why having this framework to work within is really critical and important in terms of informing our work.
Right, and as Farzana just very beautifully said, therefore we wanted to look not only at risk bases, but at protective bases.
Right.
And not only look at poor outcomes, like problematic outcomes, risk outcomes, but also things that are going right in the lives of these men. So this battery of assessments that they undergo, and we'll talk about the protocol in a moment, is really as comprehensive as possible. I mean, if we could keep them here all day and assess them, we would. But obviously,
we don't.
But we're trying to capture as many aspects of their lives as possible. Another thing that's really important in this study is that we have come to this work with a belief that looking at race alone, while important, is insufficient. And that we believe socioeconomic status is a critical driver of this disease, and that the interaction of socioeconomic status and race are probably more helpful in thinking through why the epidemic is lodging itself in certain parts of the population, in addition to homelessness and housing instability. So a lot of the work that we're doing is really, one, first of all, recruiting a sample that is very diverse in terms of race, ethnicity, but also very diverse in terms of SES,
right?
So that we can really try to make do smart analyses that attend to these nuances that exist in the population. Let me just say that in a slightly different way. That we believe that if you look at a young white man who is of upper middle class, his risk factors and his risk bases look different than what a man who is less affluent, who's a white man, and the same thing across races. So the SES piece is critically important to us, and it's going to play out as you see this, as you see some of the findings we present further on. So clicking now to the next slide. Okay, hold on, guys. There we go. So this is just a schematic of what the sample what the study protocol looked like for phase one. Remember, Farzana said we recruited men who were ages 18 or just 19 at the baseline several years ago, beginning in 2009. We screened some 2,000 men and we screened them because the eligibility criteria were that they were biologically born male, that they were 18 or just slightly 19, that they believed that they were HIV negative, and they had sex with another man in the last 6 months. And by sex, we meant any kind of contact. It did not have to be anal intercourse or oral intercourse, but any kind of contact other than cyber sex in the last 6 months. So we did not screen on identity, in part because we know that during this period of time, sexual identity is still evolving. And one of our master students, Alvaro Moreira, just wrote a really beautiful article that came out in Psychology of Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity that showed that over time, sexual identity is still fluid in this population. Gender identity is also fluid in this population, as we're learning, as some of the individuals who started identifying as male are starting to identify as female as the study goes on. We recruited the sample via active and passive techniques, a lot of online recruiting. Right. So not only sex sites, but Facebook and other social network sites. Of those 2,000 or so men who we screened, about 50% were ineligible because they were outside our age range. But in the end, we came to a sample of 600. Now, each of these assessment points were tested for HIV, for an antibody test, and at baseline, we detected a 1% prevalence of HIV in the population. So the 600 men who started the study, who all believed they were HIV negative, 6 were actually HIV positive at baseline, and they continued to be in the study, but as HIV positive men.
Right.
So we assess the men in phase one every 6 months at intervals of 6 months for the course of 36 months through an audio CASI assessment, which is just, you know, a computer assessment, on a variety of factors, including this wider race, year, socio-demographics, psychosocial factors, and what have you. And, yeah. Right, in addition to the audio CASI assessment, we used something called the timeline follow-up, which is the calendar-based technique, because we really wanted to capture authentic sexual and drug-using behaviors. Now, for those of you who are not familiar, the timeline follow-up is a calendar-based technique where essentially we sit with each participant with a calendar for the last month, and for each day of that month, starting with important days like birthdays, holidays, what have you, we fill in the month with all of the sexual behaviors, including partner information, and drugs, including alcohol, that the participant used during the course of that time. So not only do we have this, like, at the end of the assessment, this really large number of data points, but we have this contextual data where we can essentially tell a story about these men. And one of our doctoral students, Michael Levy, is actually doing an assessment right now where he's actually taking calendars and trying to tell stories about these men from the beginning of the study to the end of the study. In addition to that, we did the HIV testing and counseling, very thorough HIV testing and counseling for these young men. I will say that besides testing them, they were a very critical point for us is that they tested positive, and we have this very, 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 very detailed protocol. They are linked to care right away. We have a medical director on board. We have 2 MDs who are part of our team. They're linked to care. They're linked to psychosocial services. These young men get everything that they need if they test positive with us. And then we also did, during the first 5 years of the study, urine-based drug screening, which we are not doing in the current phase, just because
the sensitivity of the screen. Didn't prove to be very fruitful.
Correct.
So.
Correct. So here, then, in the next slide is a indication of our retention, which you can see is pretty remarkable. That by the end of the 36 months, we were still retaining 81% of the sample, and that's really a testament to the team we have here and the students who like form these very, very caring and nurturing relationships with the participants. This is a snapshot of the sample at baseline. What you can see is a diversity in terms of race and ethnicity. You know, the majority of the participants were enrolled in school at the time of assessment, a nice distribution in terms of socioeconomic status. You can see not all exclusively identifying as gay or homosexual. Some of them, about a quarter of them in relationships, about 15% of them with a history of arrest. And then at the bottom right-hand side, you can see that the age at which they started engaging in receptive anal intercourse is about 16.2 of 16, and inserted about 16. So about sex begins at about 16, but it is widely different by race, ethnicity.
And the only thing I want to add to this, as to what Perry has just mentioned, is that one of the advantages, in addition to the fact that we have this large cohort of 600 young men that started out the study at age 18 and 19, we have really great representation across race and ethnicity, which is important and is different from other cohort studies that have either studied older men or men without that same distribution of race and ethnicity have had a harder time, examining differences in health outcomes across race, ethnicity, and SES.
So, you know, we can show you this demographically, but what just as important is this demographics, this next slide that looks at demographics by some other demographic factors, because I will use the term intersectional identities probably several times during the course of this conversation, because each individual comes to the study being a composite of many things that interact with each other. So, as you can see, there are differences by socioeconomic status across the races that we've analyzed. There are differences by school enrollment. There's differences by foreign-born status. There are differences by ethnic identity, gay community affiliation, and internalized homophobia. And so not all, so what do we take away from this? Young gay men are not monolithic, right? And young gay men, more so, more than that, are even within racial groups, they're not monolithic. And so we have to attend to all of these differences if we're really going to be intelligent in the way we deliver services to this population.
And these comparison factors also have importance and significance when we look not only at health outcomes, but also in terms of resiliencies, right? And so having a greater ethnic identity or greater community affiliation plays out differently across different groups for different outcomes. And you'll see that as we move through the upcoming slides.
So Perry and Farzana, we've got a question.
Yeah.
And the question is, some MSM of color don't admit to crystal meth use, making it hard to engage them. What do you think would be helpful to engage these MSM? And I think I would expand that to just say substance use in general as well.
To engage them in care or to engage them in the study? What is the question?
Well, I guess I would speak to your own, you know, to whatever experience you actually have.
Yeah, so and something that, you know, we just wrote about in an article with our medical director, Richard Green, is that there's got to be a lack of judgment, you know, around behaviors, right? Like, we have made crystal meth, like, you know, the drug of choice and, like, the big enemy, and it is a big enemy. But unless primary care providers and social workers and psychiatrists and psychologists are willing to come from a place of non-judgment around these issues, and try to understand why it is that these young men are drawn to the drug, we're going to lose them. I think it is critically important to understand why people are drawn to the drug in particular. I spent a lot of time in the early 2000s studying this drug. It seems to me that there is a desire to appear and act in a certain way that drives people to this drug. So understanding those more deep-rooted issues and accepting them and, you know, not just, you know, ostracizing people for using the drug, I think is really critically important if we're going to engage young men in discussions and conversation about using this or any drug, honestly.
I mean, I think I would agree. I think it's very difficult in some instances for certain providers to even engage young men in conversations about sexual activity, and so the notion of drug use attached to sexual identity becomes even more difficult for providers to engage with their patients, their clients, in a non-judgmental way.
The operator.
And so, therefore, it's more difficult for those men to even, you know, to acknowledge or to talk about those behaviors, right? So it's a double-edged, it's a double-sided problem.
Yeah. The healthcare study we're going to do has the first part of it is a semi-structured, really, you know, robust qualitative interview, and part of that interview is spent on the comfort of which young men have, or, you know, young gay men or YMSM have in discussing both, you know, not only drug use, but sexual behavior and mental health issues with any of their providers.
And the other thing I would add to that is that some of the work that we've done here shows that, you know, young men don't all begin drug use with crystal meth.
Right.
There's progression into substance use, but I think if the conversations can happen prior to the progression, right, earlier on, then I think we can stem some of the harder drug use. So I think we have to be careful also in terms of, like, thinking that people need to acknowledge substance use that hasn't actually happened yet.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes. So the next slide.
You can tell we have very long answers. You don't really want to ever get us started because we can't stop.
We're on slide 17. Okay. So on the next slide shows sexual behaviors by race, ethnicity of the sample at baseline. Now, you will notice that there's a box on black, non-Hispanic, and this is going to come back later. It's going to be of critical importance to our conversation. You see what I think many researchers have seen is that young black men are not having more unprotected sex than other men. Yet we know epidemiologically that they are more likely to be HIV positive.
And we'll talk about that in a few slides today.
Right.
But we want to at least set the stage here, because at this age, there's this notion that there's greater sexual activity and there's greater sexual activity that puts patients at risk. And even our data shows that that's not the case.
That's right. In fact, the majority of sexual behavior is going on at 18 to 19, and it's changing because we've just modeled, and you'll see a few slides from now. A lot of oral at the beginning, and then it changes over time. But I think the takeaway here is, one of the takeaways here when we get to other slides later also is, it's not just about behavior, right? Because if it was just about behavior, then the black men should be through the roof, right?
Our happy slides everywhere would not look the way they do.
Exactly. Okay. And
in surveillance.
And so this next slide is a slide that sort of examines mental health burden population. When we look at depression, PTSD, and any suicidality, and we did see that some factors were really important in disentangling what mental health burdens look like, including being unstably housed and not being engaged in schooling. More powerful predictors than race or ethnicity. Although this very same paper did show that young white men were more likely to access psychological services than other men. And finally, and then I'm going to turn it over to Farzana, I believe, is this model. So for a very long time, a model of syndemics, basically what the model of syndemics is, first appears in literature around 1994 from Merrill Singh, who's an anthropologist at the University of Connecticut, who posits a theory that says, basically, that health problems are overlapping and that health problems are driven by psychosocial burden, something that we really live and believe here. But a lot of the research that's been done used additive models and basically added up burdens and correlated it with risk. And what we wanted to do and what we showed here in this slide is in the structural equation model is basically that there's this theory upholds even when you use more sophisticated methodologies, in that mental health and drug use, in fact, do interact to create this mega construct, and that mega construct is related to unprotected sex. So this is just a measurement model to add even more, you know, power to this theory that we believe to be true.
Okay. So the next part of our presentation and really some of the important work that is pertinent to getting to zero and what we're talking about today and the implications for that is looking at HIV incidence in this cohort over time. So as we've been talking about, we recognize that HIV incidence and the risk for HIV sort of conversion is not just about an individual's characteristics. So in addition to looking at person level or individual level factors such as race, ethnicity, and SES and school enrollment, we also look at behavioral and importantly contextual factors like HIV prevalence in the neighborhood and poverty level in the neighborhood. And let me just move next. So just a little bit of background in terms of how we conducted this analysis. So you know that the folks who are in this first part of the study were coming in for 7 visits. And that's what we saw. They completed at least 6 visits. On average, 50%, I'm sorry, not on average, but 50% or more completed all 7 visits. We had them for about 2.5 years on average, and a median or 50% completed almost 3 years. But most important here is that I want to point out that there were 43 individuals who were converted. So of the 594 that were HIV negative at baseline, we had 43 seroconversions, which yielded a cumulative incidence over the course of the 3 years of 7%. And I just want to point out that, you know, again, as we noted earlier, folks were being tested every single visit. So in order to be an ethical cohort study, we had to provide counseling and testing for all the participants in our study, and that may be some of the reasons for why there's a slightly lower HIV incidence rate than I think what has been shown in the city's surveillance statistics.
I would say that the minute you ask the question, even a cohort study is an intervention.
Right.
So the minute these guys are coming in and talking to us about their sexual lives and about their drug lives, there's got to be it has an effect. So in some ways, being in the study is protective.
Right. So now we looked at HIV seroconversion by just some basic sociodemographics. And remember earlier we showed you that black men in our study were not reporting greater sexual behavior than white men. But what we've seen here is that in terms of seroconversion, Black men were twice as likely to share a convert over the course of the study than white men. And in terms of SES, individuals who reported a lower perceived familial SES were also more likely, 50% versus 32%, to share a convert over the course of the study. So again, this notion of like race, ethnicity, and SES and the intersection of the two really begins to play out in our data, in our findings in the study. Next, we looked at some individual level behavioral characteristics, and what we found is that men who reported an earlier age of sexual debut or sexual onset were more likely to steer or convert. So men who reported a sexual debut on average of like 13 years versus 14.7, close to 15 years, are more likely to steer or convert than those. Okay. And the next thing I want to show you, which is really important, is this notion is the area level HIV prevalence. And what we're basically showing here is that in areas with a higher HIV area level prevalence of 27.9 to 46.4% prevalence, we see higher rates of HIV seroconversion than in areas with a lower HIV prevalence. And this is, again, reflective of what the DOHMH has reported and shown in areas where there's a higher level of HIV prevalence and likely to be related to a higher level of neighborhood level viremia, that there's a higher rate of seroconversion. And again, this is going to coincide with poverty levels, with race, ethnicity, and with SES. So we're beginning to see the intersectionality of these factors play out in these data as well. And these are just some basic Kaplan-Meier curves, survival curves showing time to seroconversion. And basically what you're seeing here is the lower line, the dark blue line, which is the individuals who report a lower perceived SES have a lower survival rate than those who report a middle or average SES, and in particular, much lower than those who report a higher SES. And again, you know, this is not surprising and is also reflective of the city's statistics.
Right, and by survival, presumably means more likely to be HIV
positive,
right?
Yeah, for time to cure conversion. And finally, what I just want to show off here is these are relative risks. It says adjusted hazard ratios, but they're essentially their relative risk for seroconversion. And what's the takeaway here is that black men were more than seven times more likely to seroconvert over the course of the study compared to white men. Interestingly, we have this mixed and other group, which is a combination of individuals who report multiple racial ethnicities or biracial, et cetera, who also report a higher seroconversion risk compared to white men.
And we'll say though that in that mixed other group, which includes the Asian Pacific Islander men,
yeah,
none of the seroconversions are in Asian Pacific Islander men.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and then the other thing I just want to point out again, and this is also reflective in the survival curves shown earlier, is that again, low SES men who report a lower perceived SES were more than two times likely to seroconvert over the course of these 36 months compared to men who are in high SES. So not just about individual behaviors, but about race and SES, context matters here.
Right.
And
an analysis we're going to be doing this summer that we're just about to begin, we're going to look at the onset of drug use and sexual behaviors from a variety of demographic and psychosocial factors just to see what predicts the age at which people start to do these behaviors, because I think that's part of the conversation here. We said earlier that we've been following this men over time, and here is an analysis we published recently that looked at the first few waves of data collection, B6, 12, and 18. And what you can see here pretty consistently is that while there's use of alcohol, we categorized our drugs into four major groups, alcohol, which, by the way, became alcohol to intoxication as we moved on, because
yeah,
we realized a glass of Chardonnay is not, you know, seven gin and tonics. Marijuana use, inhalant nitrate, and other drugs, which they really a hodgepodge of other drugs including meth, but also the use of pharmaceuticals without a prescription. And what you see pretty consistently across the board here is over time, as these young men become older, there's more substance use.
And there's more disclosure of substance use.
That's right. And here, in fact, is another a breakdown of just alcohol that shows in particular large increases over time, that white men are using alcohol much more than other men, and this is consistent in the literature. Alcohol use and alcohol to intoxication among white men is much higher than other racial ethnic groups. But again, in general, across groups, pretty much an increase over time. And then the next slide here looks at the sexual behaviors of the sample. And as you can see on the left-hand side there, and if I wish I could actually read what that says, number of episodes of insertive anal, and the top is insertive anal and the bottom is receptive anal. And what you see here over time is that there's relatively low amounts of these behaviors, but a slight increase that goes over these first four waves of data collection. We are now analyzing the data for the first 36 months. The slope is even steeper. By the time they get to be 21 years old, there's a lot more sex going on there. And on the right, in this very, very sort of jammed picture, is what you're seeing there in particular is that increases or decreases or stabilities in sexual behavior that show in particular that black men are not increasing at rates that are comparable to other groups in the sample, getting us back to our point earlier. We also did an analysis looking at factors that predict why somebody engages in unprotected anal intercourse. And I want to point out something, and I'm going to tell a story around this, and the story about being in a relationship. I like to call this the I love you factor, because I think we all know deep down in our hearts that when in young men or young men and women, when they're in a relationship, a lot of the rational decision-making goes out the window. Emotions take over and decisions are made based on passion and love and infatuation, right? So this is always my issue with social behavioral models in terms of interventions, because really, when love's in the air, self-efficacy goes out the window. So I point this slide out because what we find in this particular analysis is that the risk factors for engaging in unprotected anal intercourse are things like unstable housing, which one might predict, and a history of arrest, as one might predict, but also very strongly being in a relationship. And so my belief is, as we roll out PrEP, which I think is amazing, the notion that PrEP is just for one time when people are dating, which is in some venues being discussed, I think when somebody's in a relationship, PrEP needs to continue, because I think that's when a lot of the decisions are being made about a lot of the compromises being made around safety. And Chris's study on non-monogamous couples, I think, will bear that out. So I think as you go forward into the world and think about how to implement PrEP, you know, maybe you just, when you're, I mean, it's certainly at the beginning of a relationship when things are like lusty and, you know, unstable, yeah. It's probably not the time to stop using PrEP.
And we'll see this. So we've done a qualitative study looking at attitudes towards PrEP use, and we have some interesting comments from participants themselves about what the implications of PrEP use are in relationships. But it's important, I think, to begin to move out into these relationship contexts, because relationships are both sources of strength and protection, but they can also be sources of negative or unwanted influences. And so one of these is this unprotected sex, but the next is something that has not been studied so much in the young MSM population, the young gay men population, and it's something that we really began to think about very much in this study, and that is intimate partner violence. We know that rates of intimate partner violence in the YMSM population range, and they range dramatically from anywhere from 8% to 41%. But we don't know why these differences exist. Part of it is because of the way IPV has been studied, and we really don't have a good sense of some of the factors that are associated with both the occurrence of IPV and some of the outcomes that are associated with IPV. And so we began thinking about both substance use and sexual behavior in relationship to IPV experiences in this population. And let me just move to the next slide. Okay, there we go. So the first thing we began to look at was substance use in relationship to IPV.
Can I just add something before you go on,
yeah,
which I think is really important here, is, and I don't know if we have a slide on this, but there's a high association. We looked at both victimization and perpetration, so in the context of the relationship. And it's really important to note that in this sample, that people don't necessarily fall squarely in one bucket. that often victimizers are perpetrators and perpetrators are victimizers. So I think that's really important to think about as Farzana is presenting these data, which is going to show that violence, period, in a relationship, and you'll remember the logic model earlier that violence is one of the health problems that young men face, is related to very much their substance use and their sexual behavior. And Farzana.
So here basically what we did is we looked at intimate partner violence, as Perry noted, by three different domains. We looked at experiences of any IPV, whether you had been a perpetrator or a victimizer because of the potential for overlap. And then we looked specifically at victimization, so experiences of IPV and perpetration, engaging in IPV. And what we found is that, you know, across the board, there is greater use of substances, alcohol, marijuana, stimulants, and other substances across these three domains. And in particular, you know, individuals who reported engaging in any IPV were 6 times more likely to have engaged in other substance use, so typically harder substances beyond alcohol, marijuana, and other stimulants. So there's a lot of overlap of these health issues, and it warrants not just substance use treatment or mental health treatment, but a comprehensive assessment of both these behaviors and outcomes. The next thing we did is looked at different types of sexual behavior with relationship to IPV, intimate partner violence, because of the different power dynamics that play out in a relationship. So we were interested in not just any IPV and not just unprotected sexual behavior or sex without a condom, but we were specifically interested in the differences between anal insertive and anal receptive. And what we see is that for anal insertive, while there is a greater reporting of unprotected anal insertive behaviors, 2 times more likely among individuals who report perpetration of IPV, if you look at receptive behaviors, individuals who report any IPV experiences of victimization or perpetration are more likely to engage in anal receptive intercourse. So I think the disentangling of the specific types of sexual behaviors as well as the specific types of IPV is really critically important as we think about how these factors will play into other disease-related outcomes, right, in terms of HIV, in terms of other STIs, so not just HIV. And this is really critically important because it's not just counseling about HIV, but it's about counseling around the context of the relationship.
I will say also that in this analysis that when we're looking at sexual behavior, there's no reason that we purposely lump together all sexual behavior across main and casual
yes.
partners because we don't believe that that things stay confined, right? And so the issue here for us was like to look at the level to which violence was related to these behaviors across the board. And I want to also just note that this is for a 30-day period that we did this analysis. So forth.
So now we've done some individual level behaviors, relationship level behaviors, and we're going to start moving into the broader network of these men. And so we began to look at both their social support networks and their sexual networks. And by social support networks, we're talking about individuals that these men perceive provide any type of emotional support, you know, who they can turn to for advice, who they can turn to for emotional support.
Comfort,
thank you. Who they can turn to for tangible support, you know, if I need a place to stay, if I need to borrow some money, who can you go to? Do you have friends you can go to? And then other types of informational support, who can you go to for advice and whatever. And so we began looking at just generally their network size. And what we found is that network size differs by race ethnicity, okay? Fewer black men report having larger networks compared to white men. We looked at the composition of their networks, right, of their social support networks, and who are these individuals? Are they sexual partners? Are they family members? Are they friends? And you can see that that differs as well by race ethnicity. And then how often do you communicate with your network members, with your social support members? Because that's really a measure of how close you are and how strong the networks are, as well as the length of these networks. You know, how long have you known these individuals? And that also differs by race ethnicity. Okay? So the next thing we did is we looked at sexual networks, also by race ethnicity, across white, black, and Hispanic Latino men. And what we found is that, first and foremost, fewer black men, or black men report fewer or smaller number of total sexual network members than Hispanic, Latino, or white men. And that's important, again, when we think about, you know, who these men are having sex with and how this places them at risk for HIV and other STIs. Okay? So it's not just their behaviors, but it's who they're having sex with. So black men are more likely to have, while they tend to have smaller sexual networks, the age of their network members, their sexual network members, tends to be older compared to white or Hispanic, specifically compared to white YMSM. They tend to have partners who are racially concordant, okay? And while they tend to report more anal sex, they tend to report using condoms when they have sex, which is interesting compared to their white or Hispanic Latino counterparts, and also interesting when you look at and you remember back to the incidence rates that we showed you earlier. So there's a lot of information here about not just who they are, what they report doing, the context, their relationships, and then their sexual network. So all of this information is essentially different pieces of the puzzle that we have to look at comprehensively when we think about risk across these groups.
And there's another question that just came in, and it is this. In African American communities, there's a huge amount of stigma from family background to the church, et cetera. Could this play a huge factor in why MSM of color are at higher risk for HIV and the other rings in the circle that were mentioned earlier? And do gay men in the white community face similar stigma?
Oh, I love this question. Oh, my God.
That's a multi-layered question.
So we start with, so I think the theory that we believe in would argue that anything that creates psychosocial burdens in the life of individuals, whether the source is bigoted politicians who do not believe in equality for gay people, to families that are discriminatory, add burdens to one's life. Burdens in one's life leads to mental health issues. Mental health issues are related to risk behavior. So stigma from families and churches, yes, it's a risk factor.
Yes. What we found is that, and we don't have time to present this information here, but when we looked at factors that are evocative of resiliencies in these young men, those resiliencies are lower among African-American YMSM or African-American gay men than among other racial ethnicity groups. They're also tied to gay community affiliation. So people who feel like they're part of a gay community, right, who have developed a sexual identity, who've been able to come out and openly admit and acknowledge that I'm a young gay man, have more resiliencies or have this greater tendency to feel like they can cope with life than do individuals who haven't been able to have those same positive experiences in terms of expressing their sexual identity and in terms of coming out. This plays across race, ethnicity, and yes, it is certainly linked to family reactions, church reactions, et cetera. Before we go too down this very thorny path, I also want to say, families can play an important, positive, and supportive role. This also doesn't just break out by race and ethnicity, but it also breaks out by SES and context of the family. So I don't want to just make it a black versus white picture
right.
in terms of family and
right.
and church and religiosity, but I also want to remind everyone that it is an SES picture as well. So, and then I don't want to make it all about, poor people versus not poor people. It's an intersection of both. And I think we have to remember that.
I have one more thing. I also don't think that the experience is, I'm going to add two comments. I think that, first of all, for young black men, as Farzana said, accessing, being part of a gay community at large may be protective. I can argue the other side, too. But nonetheless, I'll leave it at that.
I'm just talking about
We have
the other data that point the other way.
But number two, I think to that point, racism exists in the gay community, right? And we all know that. And so for young black men who may not feel that they have a home in their own neighborhoods and with their families and their churches, they might experience a similar tension in the gay community at large. Point number two I want to make around white men is that I think an understudied group is young immigrant white men. Because I think the experiences, the writing and the download of young black men and the experiences of coming out of these young men is very similar in some ways to young white men who are coming from traditional European religious families, and they're coming out.
Or young Asian Pacific Islanders.
Or young API men. I think that it all plays out, and it ties SES, and it ties to, like, how rigid the values are within the family and in the community and what have you. And I think those are really, really, really critical issues.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we have been discussing for so long at our center is how do we try to engage more young Asian Pacific Islander men? And it's really difficult. It's really difficult to do. And what we found is that when we first started the study, trying to recruit young API men at age 18, a lot of them weren't ready to come out. You know, a lot of them weren't ready to openly say that I'm a young gay man or I've had same-sex experiences,
right,
which wasn't an eligibility criteria for the study. And this was really difficult to recruit. And so it becomes this problem, you know, it's difficult for them to admit, it's difficult for them to acknowledge, it's difficult for them to come out, and therefore it's difficult for them to be part of a study where we can then provide information that can inform intervention.
Yep.
So it's this really awful negative feedback loop that we've been caught in, and we're trying to ameliorate with this second phase of the study.
I think sexual minorities in general just benefit from the normalization of same-sex relationships in our country. You know, I think the more laws that are passed that are protective, you know, I mean, people say to me all the time, like, you know, it's easier to be a gay man than you were a gay man, period, 18 in 1981. And I say, well, maybe, I don't know. I said, you still turn on the TV and you're bigot on the TV. Yeah. And so, yes, maybe a little bit, but
in
your church. But let's not make believe that everything is just hunky-dory. And one of the books that I'm reading right now, which I really, 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 really have come to love, is a book by Michelangelo Signorelli, where basically he's arguing that while strides have been made in the gay in the LGBT population for rights, this is not a time for us to let down our guard. And in fact, it's probably time for us to raise our guard even more to continue to fight, because if we sort of step back and, like, you know, bask in all our glory and all the things we've accomplished, there's an opportunity for us for attacks to come in that, you know, undermines, you know, the progress that we've made. And he does a very nice job of paralleling that struggle to the struggles of women for so many years. Anyway, moving on.
So
that's a long answer.
It is, and actually there's a follow-up, and I don't want to get us too far down the path, but you mentioned resiliency. Is there a measure of resiliency? For example, does less risk equate to better outcomes?
So we have, I've been actually working with Harry and a couple of other folks here, looking at a couple of different ways to measure resiliency. So we've looked right now, we're working on looking at just a sense of, like, life satisfaction, how much hope and optimism you have, and sort of a sense of social responsibility as measures of resiliency. But there's also another measure of resiliency that's more traditionally used. It's called grit. And so we've added that, and we're measuring that now to have a sense of that in our cohort moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think resilience is a big part of the work moving forward. You know, I wrote about it in my book. You know, I wrote a book called The AIDS Generation that delineates life experiences of long-term survivors, and I spent a lot of time talking about resilience. I think, you know, what it does, resilience, grit, whatever you want to call it, determination, I think it's a characteristic of people that I think buffers against the negative effects of, you know, society and of disease. And, there's a lot of work that's beginning to emerge. And, you know, where does it come from is a big question, right? I will tell you that the men who I interviewed for the book speak very clearly to their belief that their resilience comes from their parents and how their parents taught them to fight always and how they developed a thick skin and developed grit. So I think there's something to be said for back to the role of families in developing this resilience.
Right. So the measures that we've just been thinking about or talking about are really internal ones and they're individual level ones. But others have also looked at social support as a measure of resilience and the positive aspects of a social network as resilience to as a contextual measure of resilience.
Yep.
So
cool. Great. Thank you.
That's the correct answer. There you go. Okay, so everything we've been talking about so far, we've been talking about individual level behaviors, and we started moving into the social, the relationship, and then we moved into social network. Well, we've also thought about urban settings, right? And in New York City, thinking about urban settings is both complicated, it's dynamic, but it's also really important to do because we have these really fluid neighborhoods here, right? I mean, I set up my day in Upper Manhattan. I stop in Midtown. I end up working here in Greenwich Village in Soho. I transverse three really distinct neighborhoods with three really distinct sets of demographics and on so many levels. And then, you know, I see people on the train every day who are coming in from the outer boroughs, from Queens, from the Bronx, from Brooklyn, from Staten Island where I grew up. I can even claim Staten Island. And they have such different characteristics, and they have such different structural and contextual level influences on the health of individuals, in particular YMSM. So what we began to think about was not only about the neighborhood, but about the different types of neighborhoods. So first what I'm going to do is show you where our participants come from using some of the data that the DOH has collected, and then I'm going to show you some other information that we've collected about neighborhoods. So here what you can see, what you see are map. This is just a general map of New York City, and the circles are where our participants, or the majority of our participants come from. So most of our folks are residing or report residing in Upper Manhattan, or Central Harlem, sort of the Hell's Kitchen area, which we've
Chelsea,
right. The new Chelsea, and then also outer Brooklyn, right? Brooklyn, the border of Queens. Okay, and then Upper Staten Island. So this is where our participants come from. Okay. The next slide here is from the 2012 HIV Surveillance Annual Report. And again, the circles, the red circles represent where our participants come from. As you can see, our participants are coming from or report residing in the areas that have the highest poverty levels or very high poverty levels, okay? Again, Central Harlem, Outer Brooklyn, Upper Staten Island. Okay, now let's take a look at where our participants report residing in terms of HIV diagnosis. Okay, again, same thing. They're coming from areas with the highest concentration or the highest rates of HIV. So they're residing in neighborhoods that have high poverty levels and high HIV rates, okay? So then what we decided is, okay, well, this is where they report residing. Oh, and this is one more thing. This is the same map, or the same sort of idea, where our participants come from with respect to people living with HIV/AIDS. And again, they're coming from the areas that have the highest proportion of PWHAs in the city, okay? So we said, okay, it's important to know where people reside, certainly, but in New York City, where you reside is not necessarily where you hang out, and it's not necessarily where you may be going to in order to have sex with another young man, okay? Those are very different areas. Now, I will tell you one caveat to this data, and that is that, you know, when we were asking people to report by zip code, sometimes it was difficult for us to, it was difficult for us to get all of the very specific and very accurate zip code level information. So we ended up grouping it up toward the borough level. And, you know, we know that within the borough, there's a lot of variation, a significant variation by both SES, poverty, HIV status, et cetera. But basically, what we can tell you is that where people live, right, and the majority here, 32% reported residing in Manhattan, where they report socializing, again, in Manhattan, and where they report having sex, again, in Manhattan, is very different, right? So we have to not just think about where people reside, right, when we're thinking about YMSM and young gay men, but we also have to think about where they go to hang out, to socialize, and where they go to have sex, because this has implications for where we want to situate HIV prevention and intervention programs, okay? So we thought, okay, well, you know, they report living in one place, but what's the level of concordance? So do they report having resided in and socialized in the same borough, or having resided in and having sex in the same borough, et cetera? And what you can see here is basically about 30 or more percent of our sample said no. Where they live is not where they hang out. Where they live is not where they have sex. And where they have sex and where they hang out are not the same. And so, again, the same means, you know, when we think about where to situate prevention programs, we have to think outside of where people are living. And so we have to think about what kind of data we collect. And it can't just be their zip code of residence, but we should think about, you know, where do they tend to hang out.
And with Rosanna, you know, we don't have these data yet, but we will have them soon. We did, so Rosanna led a sub-study with one of our colleagues, Justin Duncan, where we gave to 75 men in the cohort a GPS tracking system that they wore for a week.
Yeah.
And it was really actually the feasibility study, because we wanted to see if this technique had been used in obesity studies for years, and we thought, well, this seems like a good technique to use in our population. And so we will have shortly maps that show paths of where these young men have navigated over the course of 7 days, which I think will be very, very interesting to look at.
So this is just really looking at some of the demographic characteristics by neighborhood concordance, and basically what you see here is that in terms of concordance, there's significant difference by race, ethnicity, and also by perceived SES. People who are in lower SESs and higher SESs tend to have different concordance levels than those in middle SES, et cetera. So I won't go into all the details, but basically showing that, you know, it's not just race, it's not just ethnicity, but it's also the neighborhood context that matters. Oh, and it's also a neighborhood context that matters in terms of substance use, specifically alcohol use, marijuana use, sexual behavior, both in terms of oral sex and anal sex. Okay, so the next thing we did is we thought about neighborhoods, but we also thought about arrest behavior and how that was related to unprotected or sex without a condom, anal intercourse in particular. And what our findings showed is that individuals who reported a lifetime arrest history, when that was interacted with race ethnicity, had a very significant and strong impact or relationship with unprotected anal intercourse. And interestingly, white or Asian Pacific Islander men who had reported being arrested were three times more likely to have reported unprotected anal intercourse. So we thought about this, and this is compared to white men who, or white and APM men who had not been arrested. Black and Latino men who had been arrested were actually less likely to have reported anal intercourse compared to white/API men who had not been arrested. And so this was an interesting finding because it sort of flies in the face of a lot of the popular media depictions and depictions of what it means to be arrested and what impact that has. And when we looked at what the prevalence rates of arrests were in this population, we found that they were higher among Black and Latino men. And so what we concluded is it's not just about being arrested, but it's the number of times or the normalization of arrests that had this impact on unprotected anal intercourse. So it seems contradictory, but when you look at it in terms of just how frequently people and how inured or how how inured they become to these negative influences, they have this impact on anal intercourse that would had not been expected otherwise. Okay.
And so just to like sort of like we're almost at the end of our talk here, but just to sort of balance out the story even more. The good news in this slide is that
there is some good news.
There's some good news. So that, you know, is that, you know, while Black and Latino men continue to be bombarded by this epidemic, they're also more likely to have regular sexual health screenings than white men. So that is good. Because if we are living with the governor's, you know, plan, which, you know, we believe to be good and true, then screening and testing and getting on medications is going to help us get to this point where we control the epidemic. So it's great that young Black men are, you know, three times more likely than young white men to get tested and go have sexual health screenings because they are more at risk for HIV.
And whether they perceive that they're at risk and therefore they're getting more screening, for whatever reason it is, we have this opportunity, right?
That's right.
And we have to capitalize on this opportunity. So Perry's going to talk about what this means and what some of the attitudes
are. Well, how could we end this story without talking about PrEP?
Yes.
Okay, so let me just say this. So in our sample, which we think is pretty indicative of this population, there is not a lot of PrEP use.
No.
There is some knowledge, there is acceptability, but there's extremely limited use. And I think the latest data that I saw from our month, our baseline of our second 5 years, which you could think as month 42, in fact, is about 7% of the sample had ever used PrEP. And you see that they actually are having sex. So we did a qualitative study there is definitely knowledge, as the quotes show here from our paper. There is a mixed attitude about it. There is, you know, there's a belief that it could work, but there's also a belief that condoms are just as good. And there seems to be this attitude that for people who have more limited means, that this is an approach they can't ask. Now, these are a couple of years old, these data, and it's like not in light of the recent efforts to try to make PrEP more readily available. But this quote from this young Hispanic man at the bottom, I think, summarizes something that is not uncommon, which is, I have a feeling that a lot of white guys are doing this, but someone who is not white or rich, I don't really, the people in my life don't have the resources to fuck around, so no, you know. Right. So I think that's kind of not uncommon belief. And also, there was some concern on the part of the participants that, you know, using PrEP, you know,
would undermine their relationship commitments.
And that's right.
Would affect, you know, the development of intimacy within a relationship, and that's not to be disregarded. Right? Those are strong forces that we have, as Carrie's story earlier, the I love you story points to.
Right. I mean, I think it's no different from the dynamics that, you know, women experience in relationships when they want to use a condom and they have a male partner who, you know, there can be a power differential that makes the women place themselves at risk. So I think the dynamics of a relationship are really critically important here when we think about the implementation of PrEP. I will again bring home this point that these young men are not seeking this out right now. There's a whole other set of studies that we're going to do. We're moments away from getting funding to do a bigger study on HPV. These young men are not vaccinated for HPV either.
Right.
So there's a lot of things at play here. Let me say one more thing about PrEP is that when we did an analysis and we did a little sub-study to determine acceptability of an injectable form, which we do with our cause at Aaron Diamond Institute, there was definitely a preference from an injectable form of PrEP than a daily dosing of PrEP. The idea that one would go every few months for an injection seemed like a lot less burdensome to people than taking a pill every single day. Also, probably the behavior, the stigma of taking a pill every day, right, is not there. When you have an injectable, you go to a physician and get it. Now, we're not there yet with the injectables are available, but I think that when the injectables are available, it's going to provide another really accessible approach for young men around their HIV health. So let's just conclude what we think are some takeaway points from here as we wind up. I think that it's incredibly important across our data set, all the data that we showed you, that culturally appropriate healthcare services are needed, and that I mean not only in terms of race and ethnicity, but also sexual orientation and SES.
So it's not just about it's not just about educating the population or educating the community about PrEP and its availability and other prevention efforts, but it's also about educating and providing information to healthcare providers. That's really, really going to be so critically important.
I mean, I think that, you know, the IOM report of 2010 pointed to the many struggles that LGBT folks face in terms of their health, but also in terms of access to health care. You know, we're fortunate here in New York City where that may be less of a detriment, but I think that the models we build here in terms of accessing services that are appropriate and making sure that young men are getting the kind of health care provision that they need, you know, can serve as a model for other parts of the country. And this is in part informed by this belief that these services need to be provided in a non-judgmental manner. And they need to be located in a place where YMSM are. The bottom line is that young men, you know, for the most part, are not going to seek care out. I think in the last data I analyzed from the baseline of the second 5 years, some 60% have not had health examination in the last year. So how do we get them? How do we connect them to a place where there's linkage to care quickly? You know, I mean, I love the work that Dimitri Daskalakis did, our commissioner on HIV, when he went into the bathhouse and provided the services there.
Again,
I think that out of the box thinking is what's needed here.
So, you know, not just going to where people reside or say they reside, but going to where they hang out, where they socialize, and that's what our earlier data showed.
I think another important point for us to go forward with and understand is that for this new generation of young gay men, HIV is not their primary presenting issue. In fact,
getting a job.
Yeah. Right. We have some data right now. We actually included in our baseline where we had them actually rank the things that they worry about. And of 40 different worries, HIV was there, but it was number 18. And so I will say that 34 years ago when I was 18, that was the number one concern. So let's keep that historic effect in mind. And like, yay good that, you know, that we have made progress and that there are ways to control the disease, but maybe not so good that it's getting lost in the mix of things that young men are, you know, concerned about taking care of. And then I think the last thing that we have to think about is that when we're delivering services, we have to think about not just HIV health, but total health and psychological health and social health, and that these holistic approaches to care, I think, are the most effective. I will point to, every year I do a class in London where I take students to study the HIV prevention, intervention, and care there. I take them to London because I want them to see how this is how services are delivered in the National Health Service. And there, we go into the clinics where there's a patient advocate and a nurse practitioner and a social worker and a doctor. And you know what? At the bottom line is, while we have while we have 30% viral suppression in this country for our people who are living with HIV, they have 66%. So something's right about the service delivery there that, you know, that we can learn from. And that's our last slide, and thank you for listening to us.
Great. So I want to thank Perry, Farzana. I want to thank both of you for taking the time today to do the webinar for us. I think it's fascinating information. I have a couple of questions that came in through the chat room, and let me throw those at you. In your mind, what do you think are the top three concerns or pressing issues of why MSM? I guess you asked those questions, and you said, you know, they gave you a bunch of different answers. Were there three things that were at the top of that list?
Yeah, a future, like a career future, and you know, and I get it, right? And I say this story all the time. I'm going back to when I was 18. When I was 18 and I was going to college, I knew a career was possible. I had not lived through this economic downturn of 2008, 2009. So number one, two, finances, three, a place to live are among the top things that they're worried about.
Okay, great. And did your analysis include, I'm going to just read this the way it's written, did your analysis include exchange sex by race ethnicity or PrEP uptake by race ethnicity?
You know, we've had, as Perry alluded to earlier, there's not been a lot of PrEP uptake in the population in our at least in the sample in the study to date that we've gotten information on. There's not been a lot, so that examining that uptake by race ethnicity would have, to be honest, not provided very good estimates. So the estimates would have been fairly unstable and not representative at
but
that point.
But in the injectable sub study, there were no differences across race,
yeah,
right? That like acceptability of that theme and the preference for that was pretty consistent across race ethnicity.
We'll be interested to see how that plays out as these guys are getting older. So the data that we're collecting now might be more informative of both uptake and knowledge.
I think it's true. I'm going to say one other thing. I think, again, the challenge comes in that we have this really great tool, right? No one's going to doubt that this tool is great. But this tool requires close coordination with a healthcare provider, right? So if we have a population that doesn't go to healthcare providers on a consistent basis, then how is this going to really work? And I think this is something we need to wrap our heads around.
And if they can't go to a healthcare provider because they don't have a job or can't get a job, then what is that? So it's like, which problem do we try to solve first?
Or they're on a
they have
health care from their parents, so they're age 25. But that's good, but really, what if they don't want their parents to know?
Right.
You know, so there's lots of issues.
Okay, so we don't have any other questions in the chat room. So let's try an experiment. I'm going to unmute the entire room. So if people have questions, they can do that by phone, and of course, free to use the chat room. If we just get a bunch of noise when I do this, we'll have to go back and mute things. But let's see how it goes. So everybody's now unmuted. So if you have a question, you can feel free to use your telephone to ask it.
Good afternoon. This is Donald Powell from Exponents. First of all, I'd like to thank both of the presenters. My question is, how do you feel, particularly as we look at YMSM of color, what is the role that you feel like faith-based institutions need to play in terms of structural interventions? Because one of the things that I recognize, having done this work for a while, is that when you look at those institutions that are pivotal to personal development, that oftentimes send out negative messages around sexual orientation, that in itself is an obstacle to services, I believe.
I think I would start out by saying that any institution that is willing to embrace and take on the role of providing information or intervention, but can do so in an objective and non-judgmental manner, I think we would all say that's great, and we would do that, and especially if it's a faith-based institution. And as we know in the African American community, we know that the faith-based institutions have a really big role, right? And so I think that if we can have certain institutions, I mean, certain organizations that can take on that role and positively model what that would mean and show that it has a positive impact on the community, I think that would be a key tipping point.
I think it's too easy to say, to make someone the enemy.
Right.
And I think it's like throwing our hands up in despair and saying, churches will never work with us is very, and the other religions is very perceptive. We have to be very vigilant in trying to get faith-based organizations on board and in the conversation while respecting, you know, the basic tenets of that the religion brings to the table. But I think there's a partnership there that can happen that is very, very important.
Okay, well, also, if I can know where we're going.
So in short, I think we're saying we do think that there is a role that they can play. I just think we have to, you know, we have to navigate that relationship we have to navigate that relationship.
We need to get a different driver when you're printing GPS.
So a question came into the chat room. So the GPS and mapping study is very relevant to our work. How might providers find YMSM?
How do you find YMSM?
So I think you mentioned that you know YMSM don't hang out where they live, and so if you're a provider and you want to focus on YMSM and you want to find out where they are, what tools might you use to do that? I mean, besides what you're doing with the GPS.
Yeah. Okay. I think we have to stop thinking about physical spaces and start thinking about cyberspaces.
Yeah.
And I think that social network sites are a place where you can access YMSM a lot. We know, I mean, I see a generation of 18 to 25-year-olds, right? We're calling Generation Z, whatever we're calling them now, who like their whole entire lives are on their phone. And I think, I would say that that is the space that we have found to be one of the most effective in identifying YMSM.
Okay, so this is the problem with
music. I would just say that one of the things that I think you can take away from the GPS study is that because neighborhoods are flexible and fluid, trying to locate service concretely, you know, it's 5 years ago or 10 years ago, services would have been located in Chelsea, and that would have made sense. But now Chelsea is becoming Hell's Kitchen, and so what happens, like, do you pick up all that brick and mortar and you move it? So I think that's what Terry's alluding to, is that, you know, we have this opportunity to use social networking sites and mobile sites and apps, and we have to really explore those in thinking about prevention and providing services.
Yeah, I think the way to do that, I make this joke all the time, is not to get a bunch of old people like me to do that, but I think, you know, I can always tell when somebody's, like, tweeting if they're like over 30 by the kind of tweets that they do.
They use full sentences
and like correct grammar. I think we have a generation that is willing to take part in this conversation and wants to be heard. And you know, I think they should be engaged, and we should be encouraging them
to work with us and to bring to the table the voice of the people in their generation and what would work for them. I think that often those voices are lost, and I think they will lead us in the direction that we need to go into.
That's a great answer. We've been encouraging people to talk to the folks they provide services to as a main source of information for quite a few years now, and I think it's a it's one of those things. It's sort of one of those no-brainer things that people kind of just don't they forget when they start looking for, you know, different paths to take.
Right. I mean, whenever I've done my book talks over the course of the last year and a half, I've always made it the challenge of the people who are coming to hear me to bring somebody who is under age 30 to the talk, right? Because I think the conversation that happens across generations, the conversation that happens across generations is critical. It requires that my generation and our generation, the generation of older folks, you know, sort of, you know, let go of the judgment, which I think sometimes is present in our conversation. And the judgment about behavior of younger folks, and you know, just have an open mind. And I think if we can work on our part in getting rid of that judgment, younger folks are going to be much more willing to come to the table and talk with us.
Okay. On that note, I think we'll close. I know somebody had put us on hold, which is where the music came from, so I had to mute everybody again. We don't have any additional questions in the chat room. I want to thank the both of you again for taking the time today to do this presentation. I want to just take a minute or so and talk about upcoming events. So we have another webinar tomorrow at 2 p.m. on drilling down the data. So if you're somebody who loves data, and honestly, who doesn't love data, tomorrow's webinar would be for you. We have a webinar on July 18th on the SPINS New York State and cross-state evaluation progress. So this is New York links our local state evaluation as well as the cross-state, so the other five states that are involved in our national SPINS project, and they'll be presenting the progress that has been made across all six states in that webinar. Mid and Lower Hudson Regional Group Meeting will be July 28th, and it'll be in Newburgh, New York. We just heard this morning that Western New York State will have its meeting on August 27th, and we also have a webinar on August 12th where we will be presenting the preliminary results from the New York Links interventions that have been implemented by 13 different organizations across New York State. So that's what we have coming up. We hope you'll join us for future webinars, and certainly we hope to see you at one of the regional meetings. I want to again thank Perry and Farzana for taking the time out today and for putting together this webinar. It's been fascinating stuff. I think we'd like to have you guys back in, you know, a year or a year and a half when you've got some of that additional information.
We'd love to.
I also want to remind people that there is a Taking Pride in Our Health meeting on June 25th next week. It's in Harlem, and it's a large event that's meant to provide an arena for community voice, where YMSM community members and consumers are allowed to the opportunity to speak to their experience and impact the systemic changes needed to halt the epidemic. It's ties in with the governor's plan to end the epidemic, and that's going to be one of the focuses of a keynote speech. The meeting is on June 25th. It's 1 to 7 at Touro College in Harlem. So I hope if you have an interest in actually listening to YMSM and seeing what's happening in the Harlem area, you'll attend that meeting. So thank you all for being here today for the webinar. We'll see you in future places.
Okay. And thank you, everyone. On behalf of myself and Perry, we really appreciate your attendance. Have a great day.
Thank you.